Jeff here. Thanks for listening. Go to playvolutionhq.com/ccbag or click the link in the show notes for the show's archives, ways to connect, ways to support the show, information about happy hour, and more. I'm Jeff Johnson coming to you from upstairs studio in the snuggery along the Gulf of Mexico. With me, Stephanie, with her new hip. Have you named the new hip, Stephanie?
I haven't. That's a great idea.
I mean, it's not like your old hip probably had names, but So we got a lot to get into. We're going to talk about your hip replacement, mostly because I'm just interested. We got some other bone related conversation, and then we're going to get into a discussion about child development. So I'm a step closer to building my own dolphin.
Wow.
So what is it? 6-8 months ago, Tasha came home from the beach and she had a vertebrae with her, and it was big and it was pretty cool looking, and she was very happy with it and gave it to me as a present, and I was very excited, and I did my research, and it turned out it was a dolphin vertebrae.
It's
so
cute.
I got to add that to my collection. And so I decided, hey, I need to build a dolphin because, I mean, what else are you going to do with one dolphin bone? And so Monday we were out for a walk with the dogs, and Slinky found something he was very interested in, and I snatched it away from him very quickly. A rather large rib bone. It kind of put it's over a foot long, probably 14 inches long, got a nice arc in it. And so we thought, okay, there's a neat rib bone. So I wanted to add that to my collection of random bones, because I'm a bit of a weirdo, and did some search after we got home on the interwebs, and it is most likely a dolphin rib, kind of a little bit more robust than most large fish ribs. So we're pretty certain it's a dolphin. So now I have two pieces of a dolphin, and wow. I was scared to look up exactly how many bones a dolphin has because that would kind of deflate me, because I mean, if you collect two bones a year and then figure you're not always going to get the bones you need, it could take me a long time to build a whole dolphin skeleton. But I'm feeling pretty up and excited about it right now.
I guess I know the listeners can't see it, but that bone is just beautiful. The arc of it the rib is beautiful.
Yeah, wish it had some
minimalist dolphin, like,
yeah, you know, so I've told the dog there was a stake in it for him if they find me a dolphin skull. I think that'll be the hardest part to get a hold of. Of course, the dolphin, they're little flipper guys. They got almost like there's a lot of bones in their flippers. It's like proto finger bone. I mean, there's multiple bones in their little flippers, and so finding those might take a long time. So listeners, I'm putting the call out. If any of you know more than I do about dolphin skeletons, which means if you know anything about dolphin skeletons, you know more than I do, I'd love to hear about it. You can go over to myplayhaven.com and clue me in about what I need to know about building a dolphin. So speaking of bones, you had a hip replacement 2.5 weeks ago. How's that going?
It's going great. I am don't need my walker anymore, using the cane to get around, and I've already been able to go up and down my steps doing laundry. I just put a load of sheets transferred from washer to dryer. I took my own garbage out. I guess that means I'm ready for pole dancing. That's what I figured.
Oh, well, please send me video if that happens. Going to pole dancing class, I assume that it would be one of those workout classes, not that you've got a part-time job.
No, I don't have a part-time job.
That would be big news to podcast listeners. What titanium? Is that what they make them out of? What are they made out of?
Ceramic.
Well,
yeah. I think, I mean, there is metal in it, but it's, I think the most of it is ceramic of some sort, and it's supposed to last, you know, like 20, 25 years. They don't really know because they haven't had these bones available for very long to know how long they last, but they're supposed to last long. It feels great. Like almost no pain. I'm not taking any more pain medication. I have to watch it. I'm not allowed to fall.
Not sure. Sure. You can't, you're probably not tap dancing yet, but
I never could.
It'd be amazing if you could tap dance now with a new hip. Well, I can't wait till 25, 30 years from now when it wears out and you get a new one and we can talk about that. That'll be great. So you were saying before we turned on the mics that less than an hour the whole surgery took?
Yeah, I was wheeled in at 1:45 and at 2:40, the doctor texted my daughter and said, "Your mom's out of surgery. She's in recovery. Everything went well." So I don't know how that possibly can happen, but
I'm
a turkey in that amount of time.
Yeah, I'm amazed. I've had oil changes that take longer than that. I'm sitting there looking at a magazine, waiting. I mean, that's amazing that they can do that quick and that well. What kind of patient were you? Not in the hospital, but as far as if you're done with the walker and all that stuff already, you must have been a good patient. But I assume they give you a list of things you got to do, and then you got to do them.
Yeah, I've been really trying. But the biggest thing is for the first 2 weeks, you're supposed to mostly be in bed. Uh-huh. And you're allowed up 3 half hours a day to sit, to have meals. And you're supposed to get up and walk with your walker 10 minutes every hour and do all these exercises. But staying in bed and staying still is not easy for me. Which early childhood person that you know could like be still? So I asked them. Last time I didn't do a really good job with it and it went fine. But I thought this time I'll ask. And they said, "Well, you actually need to be in." I said, "Why the bed?" And she said, "Well, because you're supposed to keep all of the pressure off of your hip. It's supposed to be on your back and your thighs. And if you're sitting up, it's on your hip." And that was a good explanation. So I did better this time, but then my computer slid off said bed and shattered. And I decided that was the end of me being a good patient. So
that's hard when your computer shatters because you can't go online and order another computer when your computer's broken.
I ordered it on my phone. It was the most terrifying thing I've ever done in my life. And I have a small phone.
I'm not sure what you're getting. Well, I'm glad you're coming through it. Okay. I'm not a good direction follower, I guess. The closest I had my appendix burst 20 plus years ago because the doctors I was in pain and I knew I had appendicitis, but they thought it was something else and blah 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 blah, and they finally realized it was my appendix when they were near bursting. They burst on the way to the OR, and so that led to a couple days in the hospital because of all the chances for infection and sepsis or whatever it is. I mean the morphine was great, but that after 3 or 4 days they let me go home and they're like, you need to rest. I had a couple staples in, but I also had this gap where they had to make an extra incision that Tasha was instructed, and they showed her how to pack it with gauze every 4 to 6 hours and then pull it out and clean it out with saline and then repack it and everything. And it's like a magician pulling 6 or 8 or 12 foot of gauze out of my gut and everything. And I was supposed to, you know, not be active. And the day after they let me out of the hospital, I was pruning in the yard, because if I didn't get my lilacs pruned, then I wasn't going to have good lilacs the next year. And so I'm pruning these big lilac branches and loading them in the pickup and jumping up and down on it to pack them down so I could get a big load on to go to the dumpy place and going and dumping them. And I pulled out a staple but I still lived.
I think so. What the thing I keep thinking about, and I bet you thought the same thing, is that of course there are rules, but you know, we know as developmentalists that everybody is at a different developmental level, and most people who have are like old. And I, chronologically, I might be, but goodness knows, not emotionally or physically. So they don't really apply to me all the way. And I'm sure,
absolutely.
Like people who have their appendix bursts are either little kids who like are clueless or old people, and I'm different.
And I was kind of assuming since they'd botched the whole diagnosis beforehand, and if we would have gotten into the operating room 2 days earlier, like I wanted to, it wouldn't have happened. So I figured, well, they're being extra cautious because they don't want me to recover right because of this other end. So I'll be kind of compliant and still glad I did it. So that's probably enough bone talk. You were thinking about development lately, I'm interested in hearing what you're thinking and getting to that conversation. So what's up?
So I've been thinking about a lot of things over I have nothing else to do. And I guess one of the things that started maybe in December, I was talking to somebody who had been a former student of mine who's now really far advanced in the field, and about Pennsylvania's Uber lords of professional development. We may have chatted about this before. And I said, here's my problem. I've been in the field for 50 years. I taught in childcare 50 years ago. And I do not, in my heart of hearts, think that as a field, as a whole, that things have gotten better for children. I think that there are outstanding people, there are outstanding programs, but there were back then too. And all the money that's been put into all of the structure, like we have all this new knowledge. Why isn't it better in the classroom?
Why hasn't things gotten better?
Why isn't it gotten better? And she was just like, well, I mean, I think it probably has. And I said, well, I don't. And if you look at the research, I really don't think that it has gotten a lot better. And we can blame it all on the children. But to me, what was really dominant then was that child development was what everybody was focused on. Like real child development, not the learning piece, not all of this other stuff, but just looking at child development. And it wasn't, I mean, you know, they were crappy. I mean, people did calendar time in the 70s. I didn't, but some people did. But I I was in this other conversation about, and everybody was talking about the difference between what we should really be talking about is early care and not early learning. And again, to me, that's a false dichotomy. And development's the tree that those are both are branches off of. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. And then I started thinking about it and listening after I told you I wanted to talk about this. And like, I mean, you know, everything has the word development in it, like developmentally appropriate practice. That's kind of the mantra.
If we're using the word, then it must be happening.
I don't know. I mean, what do you think from your point of view? Because you have a very different, different life experiences in the field than I do.
Well, I'm looking at what you were talking. I just pulled up an article. If you saw my face going different drays, I was looking at the other monitor. An article from January 18th, 2024. Evidence mounts that pre-K harms kids. Education in addition to this article, Education Week published an article not too long ago called Preschool Studies Show Lagging Results. Why? Another one I was linked to after reading that article is some research titled "Why Are Preschool Programs Becoming Less Effective?" So it's absolutely a thing. And I mean, I guess my take is that part of the problem is that although money has been pumped into early learning in at the federal and state level in a lot of states, a lot of that money is going into creating new layers of bureaucracy instead of into actual classrooms where they're actual human children. And more regulations. I was messaging with a friend of the show the other day about the state of Washington is now, they're kind of in a childcare crisis, just lack of caregivers. And so they had an emergency thing where they, and look, I'm probably butchering this, but I'm the actual numbers, if I say any numbers, are going to be wrong, but the idea is right. They increased the number of children that could be in a family childcare program temporarily because of this crunch. And now they're looking to make it permanent, but not quite as high. But one of the things they're looking at changing in the rule book is the need for hard plumbed fire sprinklers, fire repression in the houses of caregivers, which this person I talked to, longtime listener, I don't know if she wants me outing her, so I'm keeping her name out of it. But she said, you know, it costs $70,000 to do that in her house. And so we have not only more level, I mean, we have infant toddler specialist, which look, some of them are wonderful, but some of them don't know anything. Right. But then we've got fire departments and them deciding, okay, we need to do this. We need to have these sprinklers. Then we've got licensing saying, hey, we need to have these new regulations. And then we have quality rating systems saying, hey, we need to jump through these hoops. Mm-hmm. And all of that is a tax on the time and attention of the people doing the direct care. Mm-hmm. And that impacts the level of emotional reserve that they have to give to the children, because when they're stressed about getting the paperwork done, it becomes very, very difficult to focus on the fact that Kevin is struggling with something going on in the block area and needs some focused direct attention.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess.
I mean, I think that I hadn't really thought down to that, the energy of the caregiver's level in that way. I 100% agree with that. I guess I was also thinking about, and I actually told this woman I was speaking to, that I said, I know you're one of these people who is in this infrastructure that has built up over the past 20, 30 years in my state. But if I know you probably are making, I don't know how much you make, but I said, I'm assuming that you make in your position more money than I made as teaching at a community college, which was way more than somebody who's actually taking care of children. And I said, took all of those administrators, all of these, this layer of bureaucracy, as you said, and you took their salaries and you put it into the pocketbooks of caregivers, you'd have people who would stick around in the field and be able to support their families in a less stressful way, which would then in turn like spill into the quality care for children.
Sure, absolutely. If you created a market for that actually enticed people to want to work in the field, you would have a more dedicated workforce in the field. And but then part of that is even working conditions, because there are plenty of people out there that are passionate about this work who mm-hmm. are in situations where they can work for not optimal pay just because they have that passion. Right. And they are often driven away just because of the stress and pressure and the fact that they want to work with kids and they end up doing paperwork instead. Yep. And so I think people that are really committed to the field are getting driven out for all kinds of reasons. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've talked to directors that talk about the idea that, you know, staffing is like having a revolving door. It's just hard to find good people and keep them. The terminology I've used on the show for years is the idea that a lot of programs are stuck hiring just warm bodies that help you stick within ratios. And, you know, if you're a warm body and you can pass a background check, you probably don't have a big background in child development, and then it's hard for you to care about child development, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a huge part of it. And people who do have a background, like an academic background, a teachery background, want to teach. They want to do the, a lot of people that I've seen in the classrooms are in there because they can't get public school teaching jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't know diddly squat about play or about development or about what a 2-year-old is supposed to be able to do, because what they learned about was elementary school kids, and they maybe had like half a class one time on here's the milestones of development or something. And they, you know, it's that, what do you think of as teaching? As compared, like, instead of saying my job is to help this child develop from wherever they are in all of the ways, and they're all integrated, and be happy. And like, that's where the resilience piece comes in. Is like, you know, it's have a relationship with that child, provide all. Yeah. Anyway,
I've met plenty of people who have come from like elementary ed backgrounds into early learning, because they realize that's where their heart is. Mm-hmm. Some of them produce episodes of this podcast with me, and some decided when they got into elementary ed that this isn't for me and went to early learning, and some decided, hey, I can't work in the school district anymore, I'm going to take this job in this program, and then fell in love with it. But on the other end of the spectrum, there are those people that can't get or find that job with the school system and start working in an early learning program, and then they feel they're overeducated and not being paid for what they're worth. And like you said, they don't have that specific knowledge in early learning. So not only don't they have the knowledge, but they're kind of angry and grouchy about their position, which is no way to engage with 3-year-olds.
Really? I always found it was a great way to get kids to warm up to me.
I mean, it's one way of doing it. But and so if you're feeling you're underpaid and overeducated and that you don't understand what these drooly little snot-nosed people are up to, it's really hard to be right there, right now, focused in the moment. And a percentage of people will decide, well, I need to educate myself so I can be good at this job. And I think a larger percentage are, I'm just going to muddle through it.
Yeah, I think, you know, the passionate people are always going to do the passionate things and learn more and continue to like embrace whatever they can do. And they're going to look at themselves, their own not being able to tune into one thing or another as part of the problem rather than it's all the kid. But I think that there are a lot of people, and, you know, if you're making 10 bucks an hour, I mean, it's hard to feel like you want for many people to get motivated to learn more, especially when the focus is on, you need to get the paperwork. I mean, that's a whole nother issue, but you need to get these kids ready for kindergarten by making sure that they all read by the age of 3 or something stupid like that. And like, well, if that's where your energy, you're being told that's where your energy should go, rather than, you know, like wiping their noses and playing and rolling around on the floor with them, you're not going to be providing for their development.
Yeah. And I mean, that's a big piece of it. And so we've become so outcome focused. We need to be able to do blah, 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 blah by the time kindergarten starts. Although I haven't run into a state or jurisdiction where the requirements to attend kindergarten is anything more than having a specific birthday by a specific date. That's what school readiness means legally, but they have all these other expectations. Right. And so the program's focus, even if they have caregivers that want to focus on child development and play-based learning, they feel this pressure for this to meet these school readiness outcomes that they don't focus on the developmental process of child development. They focus on pushing towards those outcomes, which mm-hmm. often are, I mean, it's often two different things, right? Because there are developmentally appropriate ways to go about helping a child become literate. And then there are the high pressure, high stakes ways of doing it. And they are rarely the same.
Yeah, I think that that's, I mean, Pennsylvania, where I spent most of my career, their early learning standards, I think they're pretty good. I mean, they were really thoughtfully crafted. Mm-hmm. They are aligned with Common Core, blah, blah, blah. But they're, you know, like if you read them, none of them made me angry. It's a great criteria for high quality, right?
Sure.
I mean, they were based on child development and very play-based and child-centered. And I could be very happy teaching in a classroom knowing that I was meeting those standards, and I help college students figure that out. But they're big, they're huge. And somehow it doesn't translate into, you know, like I would have my students take the standards. I'm like, all right, you find calendar time in there. I dare you. You take it. Sure. You can take all freaking semester if you want to, but you when you find the word calendar time in there, you that it's required, it's part of the standard, you bring it to me and I'll give you an A.
Sure.
Nobody could, because I wasn't in there. And it's, I think that that's, you know, that's a piece of it too, is just there's so much of the, like, there's so many words, there's so much of this infrastructure, what we're supposed to do, that it's hard to just going to get clear to, like, well, what should we, you know, how do we help this 3-year-old like have a great day?
Yeah. Well, I get an example of this from just last night. I had an online session last night. It's called Zombie Vampire Veterinarian Moms, where we talk about, you know, power play, mostly the types of play that makes a lot of caregivers and adults uncomfortable, rough and tumble play and superhero play and weapons play and death play and all that robust, often violent looking type of play that is really 100% developmentally appropriate and learning rich. And I had to get a certificate, they have to fill out a session evaluation. And I had one woman fill out an evaluation, and she's like, well, it's nice to know that they can do this in some states. And I had to reach out to her, because her state approved my training and lets me give a valid training certificate for talking about this topic, because it's all on board with what they want happening in the state. But she is dealing with licensors and quality rating people who don't understand child development and nix rough and tumble play because it's too dangerous and those kind of things. And so not only are a lot of these standards written in ways like just tell us what to do, they're written in this kind of inaccessible way in a lot of ways, all those different layers of bureaucracy people have to deal with aren't on the same page. There's no consistency there. Mm-hmm. And so even if the training people are saying, hey, yeah, we don't need to do calendar time and rough and tumble play is fine, the regulation people are saying, hey, you can't do that. So
right.
What do you do? You don't want to get in trouble with the licensing people, so you don't do it.
Right. Or even that mid-level of the directors. That can't seem to come down from my experience with directors saying, you're not allowed to use shaving cream in a classroom. My students are like, yeah, we can't do that activity. I'm like, they said, it's against the regs. I'm like, bring me the regs.
Yeah.
Show me what it says that. And they're like, well, my director says. I said, well, then, you know, like, you got it. Okay. Then that's what it is one person making that decision. It's not, you can't blame it on, I'm not allowed to do it because somebody who knows more than me writ large is saying that I can't. It's that a person's interpretation of that says that, or they just don't want to.
Yeah, and I get where those individual interpretations come from, because the licensing person wants to cover their own ass. And if they say rough and tumble play is okay, and then a child breaks a bone, which is very rare in rough and tumble play, then there's a paper trail back to them saying it's okay. And they get a red check mark next to their name or whatever happens to bureaucrats. I don't, probably a promotion. I don't know how it works.
That's right. And you are now director of the entire early childhood network of your state. Congratulations.
I mean, that might be the way it happens. I don't know. But there's this cover your ass. We're wired for that as humans. It's hard to put yourself out there in those kind of situations. So the licensing people say no because they want to cover their ass, and the directors say no because they're worried about liability, and on up and on down the system, that tends to be the way it is. Aside from the small percentage of the profession that listen to dumbass podcasts like this and decide to do things a little bit differently, my feeling is, because, you know, it saddens me, but a lot of the stuff we talk about on this podcast, rough and tumble play and child-led activities and loose parts and all of this, there's a big part of the early learning profession looks at that kind of stuff as radical, really. And that's heartbreaking.
It is heartbreaking. And I guess, and that's kind of how I looped around. It was thinking about, I was doing all this stuff in the 70s. And it wasn't radical. It was the way that you worked with young children. And we've learned so much. And it just feels like this cycle of like, why is it suddenly radical now? And, you know, I think with social media and all of the, like, I mean, there's some wonderful, wonderful people who are yelling from the rooftops. In the 70s, it was all in books. It was smaller. There weren't, conferences, but it wasn't as widespread. I mean, maybe in my heart of hearts, I think, oh, that would be great if everybody who is spreading this strong, wonderful message to, thousands of people now every day, people will get it and change will be affected. But I'm not convinced that you are a very strong, I'm not talking about you, because your stuff is, I mean, that's why I love talking with you, because your background in development, your understanding of development that's what leads everything for you, it seems to me. I mean, everything you write, it's like you're a developmentalist, and that's, but there are a lot of other voices out there that maybe aren't as strong about it. And is that word development, is that important? Is it important to talk about that explicitly? I don't know.
So I would argue, partly because I'm argumentative, that compliance tends to be a much more popular word in early learning than development.
God, is that depressing? Yeah. I obviously, I don't listen to those people. I choose who I'm listening to, and the people I'm listening to are all saying great things. And I'm just trying to figure out, like, I guess because of my age and like where I am in my career, like, I mean, should I just like give it up and say, hey, it's all, good, go for it, guys. And I'm not convinced that, but the compliance certainly seems to be what many, many people are hearing far more than development.
Yeah. I mean, the schools would like kindergartners to come in. Look, it's fine if they know how to read and everything, but, or they're interested in reading or they have a zest for life, but mostly they want them to be compliant when they show up in the formalized school system. And a lot of caregivers out there want kids that will be compliant in the classrooms because that just makes their job a lot easier. And parents are also looking for that compliance too, because they've had a hard day at work, maybe work at multiple jobs or school or whatever they're doing, and they are tired and emotionally drained when they get home. And so they want a little bit of compliance in the evening with the kids and in the morning when we get up and we head off to childcare. And I mean, if you extract it a lot further than that, I think, government, no matter which flavor of political party you're interested in, there's a big interest in compliance at that upper societal level too, once you leave school. And so we've built a system that is more focused on compliance outcomes than it is on developmental outcomes.
And maybe that's really interesting, because as you were talking, what popped into my head is, what if you were to substitute the word self-regulation for compliance? Because that's really what it is, except that it's not often the way we talk about self-regulation has nothing to do with the child or the adult themselves. It's that being like regulating to that outside. I mean, that's what makes it compliant, as opposed to truly being able to, in your brain, regulate your impulses, regulate your behavior, regulate like your mouth, whatever it is that you're trying to regulate. And what we know about self-regulation is that it develops through all of the things that we've been, that are positive and wonderful. It develops through risky play. It develops through loose parts. It develops through relationships. It develops through open-ended play and activities. And so, you know, I guess I'm just like really wrestling with how do you help people connect the dots? That to me is what the big question is, because the dots are all there. Does that make any sense? I don't know.
It's really challenging because everybody's in their own silo, right? And it's really hard to reach over the top of your silo and grab somebody and pull them out of their silo into yours. And so if you're really into the more compliance focused activities and teaching at kids instead of learning with kids and those kind of things, it's really hard to change minds. Because we humans aren't really, I mean, we're notoriously bad at change period and changing opinions, specifically in this case, that you've got to, I think the best you can do is you can look for people who are a little bit open-minded to doing something a little bit different and try to feed them some ideas. And I think that's really, really hard to do. Over the years, this podcast has done it to a degree, because there are people that'll listen for the first time and they'll think, what a blowhard asshole, and not make it through more than an episode, maybe an episode and a half, before they move on to something else. But then there are other people that think, oh, they talk about dog poop a little bit too much, but there's some interesting things here. I'm going to keep listening, and then practice changes over time a little bit. And I mean, social media, there are people that are on the social media that are doing good things like that, putting little bits of information and ideas out there that kind of jostle people's thinking and might lead some people who are primed for it to change. But mostly, I think we're just fucked.
Well, thanks. That's good. I mean, I guess I was thinking as you were talking, okay, so my problem is that I'm just impatient. I don't think waiting a half a century could be really qualified as what usually I would think as impatient, but okay, I'll wait more. Because that maybe what you're saying is like you have made impact on people, you have affected change. I know I have, as in lots of different ways for lots of different people. I had students come into my community college classes who were just like, like, you don't know what you're talking about, you're nuts. And now I see what they're doing in their classrooms, and they're like, yeah, every time I think of, you know, play, I think of you. I'm like, I mean, what, like, that's
yeah. Good. What better compliment could you get?
Right. So, you know, maybe it's just, maybe I'm just feeling like impatient and I just don't, I maybe nervous because I just see generations of children and things are getting, I think, kind of tough for a lot of kids. It's like, there's no, as well as a lot of caregivers. And I just like my heart just bleeds thinking like, if everybody would just do what I say, it would be so much easier for everybody. And so
yeah,
much.
Yeah. I mean, look, I know a lot of people that would have much better lives if they would just take my advice on a daily basis, but it just doesn't tend to happen. And so I think the thing that really happens is we need people out there planting seeds. And all kinds of different kinds of seeds that lead back to what we preach about, because the way you go about approaching or opening people up to these ideas is going to be different than the way I do it, and the difference to the way other people do it. And so having a wide variety of different kinds of people out there play Johnny Appleseeds, I guess. Has Johnny Appleseed been canceled? Can we talk about Johnny Appleseed anymore? Is he, I don't know.
Hey, I had a good friend who's pretty woke who used the word Johnny Appleseed today talking about my neighbor. I think it's okay. I haven't heard about it.
If I'm going to get canceled for mentioning Johnny Appleseed, I apologize. I don't stay up on things. But I mean, if we have a lot of people out there, you know, planting their seeds, if each one of them opens up three or four more people to do ideas, and then they can go out and share those, then things change. But I'm still very cynical and still think we're fucked, because a lot of those good people end up burning out and leaving the profession. And then we got to start all over from scratch. And that's why don't make any progress, partly because of the high turnover in this profession.
Yeah. And I really do believe that it's not the only thing, because I certainly never made significant money in the profession, but I think you have to have an awful lot of passion to be able to work, or a situation where you have another source of income or don't need money and live in a yurt, to be able to survive on the money that many early care providers receive. And I think that helps. It's not the only thing, but I think it exacerbates the turnover, the rapid turnover. It's a lot easier to feel less stressed when you have, you're not worried, also stressed about like feeding your family and taking care of your kids, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
That's anyway.
That's, yeah. I mean, we lose people because of the benefits of working in the profession, the financial and, you know, other gains that they can make, but also we lose people because of the emotional side of it, because sometimes people get just drained and that's what drives them out. So there's not a lot of drawing people into the profession. Listeners, if I sound cynical, it's because I am. And sometimes I'm more, I think, Jeff, are you too cynical? And then I think, no, you're probably not cynical enough, which is also kind of disheartening, but you know, it is the world we live in, I guess. So how do we end this on a positive note? This sounds like kind of a downer episode.
I really like what you said about Johnny Appleseed. And that, I mean, to me, that is resonating, because it's really aligned with a lot of stuff that I've been thinking about, of like, you know, God, you're old, you got a new hip, you got two new hips, you go like, you're, like, why don't you just freaking retire and like, just give up everything? You've done enough. And I can't. But I think what you said about, if everybody who believes in the developmental beauty of childhood and play and all of the stuff that we believe in, just keeps like chipping away at it and sharing their message in whatever way they can, to as many people as possible, then those seeds are planted. And, you know, it may not be, who knows when it'll actually take root. I see the connected dots of all of this stuff that's happened in research in the last number of years. And I just don't understand why it's not happening faster, but you know, I guess evolution is,
yeah.
Patience. Yeah. So That I don't think that I have not lost hope. I just am impatient. And maybe instead of being cynical, you just could identify yourself as impatient, which you probably would.
No, I'm going to stick with cynical, but I'm going to top that off with I'm joyfully cynical. Look, I'm a happy guy and have a positive outlook on things. Although I try to live in Realville and there's lots to be cynical about. And I think owning that, but also owning the fact that you can go out there and plant seeds and make progress. And so I try to find a kind of balance in there, and then have a shot of rum now and then, and everything seems to be okay.
Hey, water those seeds with rum. I mean,
it's so nutritious. Any final thoughts before we wrap this up?
No, I'm glad that you're resilient in your approach to early childhood. I'm glad you're still doing the thing and coming up with your brilliant stuff. And I will continue to do it. And I say we plant those seeds and cheers. How's that?
I'm resilient in my cynicism. Yeah. Hey, listeners, if you've got thoughts on this topic or anything else we talk about, or want to talk about something else or vent your own cynicism or anything like that, you can join me for a happy hour, the fourth Tuesday of the month, 7:30 p.m. Central Time. There is a link in the show notes. You can also find it at playvolutionhq.com/CCBAG. That's Child Care Bar and Grill. When we named the show, we didn't know that that was going to spell out C-Bag, which is kind of awkward, but 1,000 plus episodes coming up on 1,100 episodes almost. We're stuck with it. That's what that's going to be. This here has been the Child Care Bar and Grill, the world's longest running and most prolific early learning podcast that hopes you're not as cynical as Jeff. Thanks for listening. Back soon. Bye bye. This has been an Explorations Early Learning Upstairs Studio production.